This is an interview with Paul Davey, who will be speaking with me, Barry York, for the oral history program conducted by the Museum of Australian Democracy at Old Parliament House. From 1978 to 2000, Paul Davey held several senior positions with the National Party of Australia, including 10 years, nearly 10 years, as federal director of the party. I should also point out that Paul Davey is a historian and writer. Today I'm hoping, though, that we can cover the early period of your life, including your migration from England in 1966, and of course your career as a journalist, including your time in the Canberra Press Gallery. On behalf of the director of the museum, I want to thank you for being part of this program. Thank you also for completing the rights agreement. And as you would understand, the Commonwealth owns copyright in the interview, and the rights agreement has allowed you to set down conditions of access to the interview. The interview is taking place today, the 12th of April 2011, in Canberra at the Museum of Australian Democracy. Now, may we begin at the beginning? I'll just ask for your place and year of birth.
Yeah, I was born in England, Kingswood, south of London, Surrey, 22nd of April 1947.
And can you tell me a bit about your family background, you know, your parents, their names, their occupations and so on?
Yeah, my father, his name was Charles Davey. He was in the outside advertising business, billboards, and it was a company that was started by his father, James Davey, who I never knew. He died before I came on the scene. So he was the managing director, the company director of James Davey Sites, and we lived in Kingswood. He worked in the city. My mother's side of my family came from the other end of the country, Huddersfield in Yorkshire, and her father, my grandfather, who I knew very well, Harry Cockcroft, he was in the wool industry, and built up a company there, J.H. Cockcroft and Company Limited, which basically dealt with blending wool stocks. And I remember we used to go up there when I was a young kid, and we'd go up there for Easter and times like that, and I'd spend all the time with my brother playing in these huge bales of Australian merino wool, which at the time, of course, I didn't realise anything about, but it was good fun playing in those bales of wool. So that was they were the two key sort of family links. I have a brother, and his name's Stephen, and he's 5 years older than I am, currently living in France. There's just the two of us, and that's it. My father died when I was eight. He had a coronary thrombosis, and my mother died from stomach cancer when I was 11, which put my brother that sort of 5 years further on. So 13 when his father died, and what, 16 when his mother died. And I think they were very impressionable ages for him, because I think the death of our parents hit him a lot harder than it hit me. I was almost at the age where, I mean, of course I knew what had happened, and I understood all that, but it just didn't sort of strike home the way it did to him. And in fact, it sort of derailed him. He never managed to get over it, I don't think, and it was frankly never been much of a success in his life at all. But I guess, you know, that was part and parcel of the reason why I thought, by the time I left school, that I'd look for a life outside England.
Did your brother look after you, or who cared for
you? Once our parents had died, or our mother had died, her sister, my aunt Peggy, and she'd recently married an ex-army captain whose name was Tom Cowan. And they lived just outside Birmingham. Now, they took us in. They looked after us. As I say, my brother was 16 then, and Tom Cowan was a very disciplinarian sort of a character, almost what you'd expect from an ex-army officer. And, you know, to the point where he made us clean the insteps of our boots and all of our shoes and all of that sort of business. It was quite strict. And my brother Stephen just didn't take that at all. You could see it all over him. He just wanted to get away. And he did. He left home and he went up to Yorkshire. He worked in the in the wool firm up there for a while. And then he got himself tied up with music. He also went to NIDA, the National Institute of Dramatic Art, to become an actor. But he seemed to think, once he got through there, that it was virtually a passport to automatic stardom, you know. He'd be the immediate Charlton Heston or something, and he wasn't too happy doing rep theatre up and down provincial England. But I stayed with Tom and Peggy, and of course I went through my senior school with them. I went to a school called Wellingborough, which was near Northampton in the English Midlands, a private school, boarding school, not up to the standard of your Eton, Harrow or Winchester or something, but nonetheless a private school, complete with all its, you know, its fagging and its standard things that happened in those days, until I left school in end of 1965, and then started the move out here.
Did your auntie have children?
No, they didn't. They married fairly late, and they didn't have any children. And whether it was something of a bonus for them to have a couple of teenage kids thrown onto them out of the blue, or whether they found that that was something horrendous, I really don't know. But they were wonderful. I look back on them both. I was always very fond of my aunt. Tom, I used to find a bit intimidating. But again, I look back on him now, he was probably the best thing that happened to me, because he drove a bit of discipline and sort of respect into me, which I don't know whether I would have quite had it as much. So, you know, they did a wonderful job, and they took on a huge responsibility, and it must have been a huge burden to them.
Mm. And did your parents own the house in Kingswood?
Oh, yes. Yeah. My father was an inveterate mover of houses. I don't quite know why, but we moved. I was born in a house called Little Thatcher's, which was a beautiful place. I went back to visit it once on a trip back to England some years later, and it's still there. It's still got a thatched roof and everything, which is lovely to see. Then we moved to another place not far away, still in Kingswood. Then we moved to a house opposite the Epsom Racecourse. And we went through one derby, and all the rubbish from the derby in the front garden and everything else. And Dad said, well, that's the end of that. We're out of here. So we sold that, went back to Kingswood. And I mean, he just loved moving houses.
Did your parents have any particular religious values or practices?
We were all Church of England. All the family was Church of England, but not hugely so, although, you know, going to church on a Sunday was a reasonably regular thing, but not every Sunday. But it was quite a regular thing. And, you know, I think we all had those basic sort of Christian beliefs that, you know, I still hang on to today. But these days I tend to only find myself in churches for weddings, baptisms or funerals. But I'm still a believer of sorts. I sort of loosely say my prayers every night before I drop off to sleep. You know, and I sort of hope in the afterlife, although I don't think I believe in it quite to the extent that maybe I did when I was a kid.
And what about politics? Were they politically minded?
No, not particularly. They were conservative. I had absolutely no interest in politics whatsoever. Didn't understand it. And so it wasn't really something that was discussed around the dinner table at home, only very occasionally after an election or something like that, you know. Of course, elections 5 years apart were fairly few and far between.
When you look back, what would you say about their influences on you? How did they help to shape you?
I mean, they obviously did, despite the fact that I'd lost them at such a young age. My father was a mad keen golfer. He was a very good golfer, and he made the crippling mistake, I think, of trying to get me interested in it by forcing me to caddy for him when I was about six, and that turned me off golf forever. Even though I've played a fair bit of it, and I'm reasonably good at it, not having had any specific training or anything, but I just don't enjoy it. So that was one impact, I suppose. Dad enjoyed his beer. He was a good beer drinker, and I think I certainly followed that trait. And Mum, she enjoyed a gin and tonic. I wouldn't say she was a heavy drinker, but she enjoyed a social drink. And they enjoyed a party. They enjoyed getting friends together, you know, at Christmas time or some other appropriate occasion, putting on a party for adults, which, you know, us kids were kept away from. And then after it had all finished, we'd go round and pick up the cigarette dog ends and light them like that, you know, empty out the glasses of sherry. But you know, I guess beyond having fond memories of them, we were a very close family, and you know, an average middle class family, you would say. I think we were a very close family, but I guess their influences on me were not extremely extensive, because I hadn't reached the age where they could really have a huge influence on me, I suppose.
And the other family that you moved to, your auntie? And
yeah, well, they clearly had a more significant influence on me, I suppose, is the word. As I say, you know, my Uncle Tom sort of put into me some sort of discipline, I guess respect for people and for property and for society and communities and things like that, respect for other people, your elders and betters. Some of all of this you get from school, of course, as well, but I think I clearly got a lot of that from him. And Auntie Peggy, she was just a sweetie. She was a softie, and she was a lovely, lovely person. And that was good, I suppose. She offset him in many respects in terms of the relationship with me. But I was very fortunate, given, and so was my brother. I mean, you know, to have suffered the loss of your parents like that, but then still have a family and a direct family to look after you, as opposed to being either put into some sort of an orphanage or completely taken away into some other sort of society. You know, that was extremely lucky, extremely lucky.
That was quite a change in environment, I would imagine, though, from Kingswood, which is what, that's the south-east, is it?
Yeah, well, it's south of London, about 40 minutes drive, I suppose, from London, in the middle of Surrey. And yeah, I mean, Surrey was, you're right, huge change, because where we went to live, where they lived in the Midlands, a place called Solihull, which was about a 40-minute drive outside, out of the centre of Birmingham. Tom worked in Birmingham with the Midland Electricity Authority. He had a management position with them. You know, I mean, it was really an extension of Birmingham. So, there was nothing, there was no countryside about it, if you like. It was quite a difference, yeah.
Can we talk about your school years briefly? What subjects did you take to? And
well, I was never too good a scholar at school. I enjoyed the playing field too much, I think. I started, as so many did in those days in England, I was sent off to boarding school when I was just seven, or maybe not quite seven. Went to a junior prep school called Cotsmore, which was near a little town called Pease Pottage, near Crawley in Sussex. And I was there until I was about 12 and a half, or 13, I guess. And then I'd moved out from that school and got entrance into Wellingborough. An interesting aside, I suppose, the school was quite small. It was a private family-owned school, you used to drive up this rhododendron-lined long driveway, and it opened out into this hugely imposing castle-like building. It was sort of, I used to call it Colditz. Very frightening to a 6-7-year-old kid. Mm-hmm. Magnificent piece of architecture in reality, just a beautiful building. It was run by a family called the Rogersons, and the headmaster, Mr. Rogerson, he was mad on golf, so he put a nine-hole golf course into the grounds. It had a lake, which the kids, we all used to go swimming in. They had horses, so you could learn horse riding. They had a rifle range, so you could do 22 rifle shooting. The opportunities that were given through that school as a junior boarding school were just phenomenal. But he, Mark Rogerson, his name was, he called me into his office. I got a message from a master, came in and interrupted a class and said, look, the headmaster wants to see you. So I went down into his office and I knocked on the door, as you had to do, come in. I went in and he said, come and sit down, and sat me on the arm of a big leather arm chair that he had, and he sat me on the arm of that, and he said, this is the most difficult conversation I've ever had to have, because he said, you probably remember that 3 years ago I had to call your brother in here and tell him that his father had died, and it's now my terrible duty to call you in here and have to tell you that your mother has died. He was a remarkable man, actually. My aunt came down and picked me up from school after that, and things started to move from there. But those were my biggest recollections from that period of my education, I suppose. But as I say, I passed the qualifications, the exams to get into Wellingborough, and Wellingborough was fun. I enjoyed it. I'd never liked school up till then. I used to hate going back at the start of the term and things like that. But I initially, when I first went to Wellingborough, I was very apprehensive about it, because, you know, you were a new brat. You had to fag for your prefects. Prefects could cane you. They had some crazy rules. But the school uniform was a grey suit. If you were under fifth form, you had to walk across the quadrangle with your jacket done up, and you weren't allowed any hands in your pockets. And if a prefect caught you, he straight off to the prefect's room, and he'd cane you with three strokes of the cane without even, you know, referring it to any masters or anything. If you're in the fifth form, still had to have your jacket done up, but you could have one hand in your pocket. Privileges, you see, privileges. Sixth formers and prefects could swagger with both hands in pockets and jackets undone. I mean, these are crazy sort of rules when you think about it, but that's the sort of schooling it was. Academically, no, I was pretty woeful academically. We had what was called the General Certificate of Education. I passed O-levels. Took me 3 years to pass 5 O-levels, which didn't give me any hope of getting into university. Not that I'd ever really thought I wanted to go to university, I don't think I'd really thought about it too much, but I knew I couldn't go to uni. And of course, then you started to get the family saying, well, look, you know, we've paid for your education, what are you going to do with yourself? And that's when I first started thinking to myself, maybe I need to get away from here, because the options were to go into the bank, or something of that nature. I did enjoy enormously at school the cadets, and I was quite a good marksman with 303 Rangers and 22s. I got up to being a sergeant in the cadets, and I thought, well, maybe a short service commission in the army mightn't be a bad idea. And this was going through my mind in that final year of school, you know, about the middle of 1965, I guess. Anyway, I got an interview with the Regular Commissions Board, and went off for a 3 or 4 day, sort of interview and assessment. And I was only barely 18. I was the youngest one there. Most of the other guys going for it were in their 20s. And I just couldn't work out. They had these obstacle courses, you know, things painted green and red, and you were told you had to get your unit of five blokes over the obstacle course without touching anything red, because red represented electricity, and if you touched that, you'd be killed. Well, I couldn't work that out for the life of me. They were very kind at the end. They said, look, you know, you're probably a bit young. Come back in a couple of years' time. you know, so I was thinking about what I was going to do with my life. In that year of 65, it crossed my mind to be a game warden in a national park in South Africa. And I actually wrote to the National Parks Board in South Africa and inquired about it. And I got a nice letter back saying that, yes, you know, and if you, depending on what you want to do, you know, there are jobs for rouseabouts, as it were. But if you want to do really handle animals, you'd have to be a vet, which means you've got to go to university and all of that sort of business. So that was out. But what really nailed it was that no matter what you were doing, a key criterion was that you had to speak Afrikaans, which of course I couldn't do, so I didn't think about that anymore. But my two greatest mates at school were, coincidentally, both Australians. Uh-huh. Yeah, one was a bloke called Pete Nankervis, and he was at school there because his father and his family were based in Bahrain. His father was a chief pilot for Gulf Aviation. And the other guy, Charlie Horsfall, his father was the Chief Justice of the Cayman Islands. Hence, his being sent to England for schooling. And, God, the three of us got into all sorts of strife. We got caught in pubs. We got caught under the headmaster's strawberry patch smoking. We just got caught doing everything. And we had a great time together. And they were great mates. So the three of us were great mates. And funnily enough, I mean, we're unfortunately, in a way, I've never seen Pete Nankervis since. I have seen Charlie Horsfall twice, but a long, long time ago now. He did get back to Australia and became a doctor. Where he is now, I don't know. Life moves on and you sort of, you know, these ties tend to drift. But they were great mates, and that's the key reason that sort of put me on a course to come to Australia.
Because I was going to ask... what interested you in Australia in the first place? Had you met any other Australians?
No, not really. Australia, of course, in the mid-60s was heavily promoted in the UK for you know, potential migrants. I'd been talking about it loosely with Pete and Charlie. I hadn't really done much about it. But I was in Birmingham one day, obviously it would have been during school holidays, and I walked past the Australian consul, and they had all these photographs in the window of, you know, Bondi Beach and this and that and all sorts of things, and open paddocks and wheat crops and sheep and all these great Australian, iconic Australian sort of scenes. And I wandered in there and I just said, look, I might be interested in applying for migration. And they gave me a whole heap of stuff and sent me away, and I started to look at it, and then I started to look at the Atlas of Australia more. I'd learned a fair bit about Australia at school.
Okay.
Because being a Commonwealth country, you know, you learn a lot about it in terms of history, but also geography. We studied it quite extensively, and I found it fascinating. I mean, just looking at a map of this massive island continent, which to me back then was, you know, almost like going off on a trip of exploration, if you like. Yeah. You know, it seemed such a distant and also deserted sort of piece of land, and so it did fascinate me. And then Charlie Horsfall's mother was married to a farmer at a place called The Rock, just outside Wagga, about 20 miles from Wagga in New South Wales. And I suppose somewhere, although I probably hadn't thought about it very much, but somewhere I must have had subconsciously in my mind a desire to go on the land. Maybe that's what made me start to think about being a game warden in South Africa or something like that. But it suddenly, you know, struck me that this wouldn't be a bad life. Get out to Australia and become a jackaroo and go on the land. And that's what was sort of arranged. I was going to, this is if I could get through the immigration tests and things okay, the idea was to come out here and go to the Rock and go and work for the Stewart family. Their name was Stewart's, on their property at the Rock. So I then, you know, I had a target. So I went back to the Australian consul, and they gave quite a rigorous sort of an interview session, and then I had to pass medicals, and then I had to wait, in the process of waiting, we formalised if I was going to come, because I was under 19. So I had to be sponsored. And of course, if anyone's prepared to take on a sponsorship of that nature, that means they're legally responsible for you, and they're also responsible for any legal problems you get into if you happen to. And that's a big call. And the Stewarts, while they were quite happy to look after me and all the rest of it, I think they quite rightly thought that, wait a minute, we don't really want to have that around our neck. So the Apex Club of Wagga was my formal sponsor. And then I got notification that, your application's approved. You should get yourself ready to leave England at short notice. Do you want to fly or go by boat? So I had no hesitation there. I mean, why would you fly when you could have 6 weeks on a boat? Which I'd never had before, you know. That's quite an exciting idea. But all of it, getting ready, all of a sudden you've got to sort of pack up your life and shove it into a... I still have my old school trunk. It was a big green school trunk. And that was basically it. I had to pile my life into there and take it with me, and that was it. And getting all that ready, and then sitting back and waiting, and you didn't know how long this process was going to take at all. And in the meantime, I was doing, I had left school then, and I did some work. I was just doing work to try and get some money. I worked in a furniture store in Solihull, just, selling furniture. I'd also worked in Birmingham's Smithfield Markets on the fruit and vegetable thing. That was a shocking job. You had to be there at about 3 a.m, but it paid fairly good money. And a few other things around that neck of the woods. Four probably. I think I left school around about October or something like that of 65. So I had a few months in which to work and earn money so I could have something to bring with me if I was going to go. Not a hell of a lot. But I'd done that, and then the letter came. It would have been probably towards the end of January, or might even have been earlier than that. But early 1966, anyway. Your application, or you're designated to be to board the Castel Felice at Southampton Dock on whatever date it was. And that's when it really hit home. My God, what have I done? What have I done? And you have that sort of sickening feeling in your stomach, I suppose, because it suddenly hit me that, well, look, I'm going off on my own. And any links and ties that I've got to people who can immediately help me, bingo, they're severed. I didn't really have second thoughts, but I had that sickening feeling, for sure.
How did your auntie and uncle feel about it when you told? Did you tell them?
Look, we discussed it over quite a long period of time, and they were very supportive. They thought, they really did think that England in the mid '60s was a country that was going through quite a transformation in a way. Different values. It was full of flower people. It was the Beatles. It was the ideologies which they had grown up with, if you like, and particularly the sort of post-war and 1950s periods where, you know, you still had respect for people, you still got out a fair day's work, a fair day's pay, things like that, were sort of slipping away. It was becoming more acceptable for people to sit around and do nothing and go on the dole and things like that. Conscription had ended. You know, there wasn't a lot around in England. And they thought that, yeah, the idea of getting out to, as it were, the new world and seeking opportunities there was fine. Of course, once the time came to go, my uncle wasn't well at that stage. He'd got tuberculosis in his legs, and he'd had one leg amputated. So he was in bed when I left, and we shook hands, and he was very stoic about it, and I think I was. But, you know, I'm sure he knew that this was the best thing I could do. So he was prepared to take it that way. My aunt drove me down from Birmingham down to Southampton, and you know, we loaded everything on, and as you do, and I got on board. I mean, we kissed and I got on board, and she stood down on the dock there and watched the streamers flying out. Tears started streaming down her eyes. She was very upset about it at the end, but I mean, again, she wasn't against it. She was just very upset that it was happening, and so was I. I mean, I think I probably cried myself as the last ropes were dropped off and the boat started to drift away. It's quite a moving sort of scene when you know it's basically for the last time. I mean, of course, it didn't have to be at all, but at that point where you've surrendered your passport to the Australian authorities, you've been issued with a single-page document of identity, and they say to you, you've got to keep this. This is the most important document you'll hold for the next 2 years under the assisted passage scheme, because it is the only proof of who you are. And you know you're going, what, 10,000 miles away. You think, my God, it doesn't cross your mind that you might be able to get back again at some point. You sort of think, my God, this is a one-way ticket to the arse end of the world.
Did you think of it as a permanent move?
Yes, I think I did. I certainly thought of it as, I'm sort of hesitating. I had no thought in my mind that I'd simply do the 2 years required under the assisted passage agreement and then come home. I never had that in my mind at all. So I certainly thought of it as a permanent move, yeah. And, you know, at the time I was coming out here to be a farmer.
Yep. I'd like to ask a little bit more, if I may, about the interview process. You said that they were quite rigorous in the initial interview. Do you recall much about what they asked? Or what was the point of that initial interview?
Yeah, it's a bit hazy now, but they certainly, you know, they wanted to know my family background, family history and everything else. They asked questions that were obviously aimed at... They were very nice about it too, very friendly. Broad Australian accents, you know, which is sort of... You immediately know you're talking to Aussies. Very gentle about it, but a lot of the questions were clearly targeted at being able to judge what my mental capacity was to do what I was going to do. You know, how secure was I within myself about doing this, or was I going to potentially get over here and be a burden on the Australian society? And then it was a matter of, yes, they wanted to know what I understood, what I knew about Australia. There were no trick questions in it or anything like that, and there was nothing like, who was the first Prime Minister of Australia or all that sort of business. I mean, there was none of that there, but broad understanding of what Australia was, what it was about, what it did, what its major economic strength was, and again, just to see how much you genuinely sort of understood about the place, I guess. All part of the assessment to see how suitable you were to be an assisted migrant. And then the medical side of it, wasn't too rigorous as I remember. They assigned me to a doctor. I had to go to a doctor, but I'd had a medical when I went for the short service commission in the army too, and it was a bit similar to that. They were particularly keen to make sure you didn't have TB. They wanted to you had to be immunised, have polio immunisation, all of this sort of stuff, make sure you weren't going to be a potential health burden or import some exotic disease into Australia. And beyond that, it was, the standard sort of deep breathing, blood pressure and that sort of stuff, and I had no problem there. So I think overall, it was a pretty solid sort of assessment on a person's suitability to go, both from a physical point of view and a health point of view and a mental point of view.
Was there a character check at all?
I suppose there probably was, but didn't tell me about it. But of course I had to fill in everything about my family history and forms and things like that, and they probably checked that, yeah.
Sometimes they ask about police records and that kind of thing.
Well, I really can't remember whether they did ask that, but I'd be surprised if they didn't. Or if they didn't, I'd be surprised if they hadn't checked through the